I invited my friend and colleague Leslie Ellis to talk about active imagination. This is a recording of that conversation.
This was sparked by reading Peter Levine's new book, which he calls An Autobiography of Trauma. One thing he does fairly early on is describe how when he was developing his theories, for about a year, he would be going to a restaurant and sitting, eating his meal, and basically having the sense of having a conversation with Albert Einstein. You know, as he describes it, he was very aware that nobody in the restaurant was seeing Albert Einstein or hearing him. And there was no dish, you know, on the other side of the table. But for him, the present felt very real. And he had a sense of a connection that was happening. And in some way, as I'm describing this, it kind of reminds me of, oh, there's a similarity with how I asked you to help me, not as an imaginary presence, but because actually what I find is that it's easier for me to articulate my thoughts or go beyond that sense of, yeah, I get something, if I'm in connection with somebody who I feel can really understand it, contribute to it, get it, and have a you know, kind of a connection and discussion there.
And yeah, so, I think that's true, Serge. I think that this is like Jenlyn's idea of focusing, how the other person, just the act of the other person getting it and hearing you, that presence creates more information just inherently in the dyad. And yeah, I'm happy to be that that reflective presence for you.
And I'm hoping that actually as we go, it goes from a more of a reflective presence to more of a conversation and your own ideas and whatever is sparked by that.
Sure.
But it feels nice to be actually right, you know, in that sense, right in the middle of it, that, you know, that in a way, what came up, one of the things that came up for me about the imagination there is that how related it is to something that was very important to me as a kid growing up and as a parent, the telling stories. And so that sense of something unfolding and the story unfolding, not just because it's a great story, quote unquote, but the story is born in the connection. And as a kid, I remember both my father and my uncle were great storytellers, and it was all about the connection. It was about that sense of excitement that my brother and I had listening to them and that they had in being fed by our enthusiasm. And then later as a parent, I discovered that the telling the story is not so much that there is so much creativity or beauty in the story, but it's kind of, it evolves in the connection.
Yeah, you feel heard. Well, I just know like the opposite is true. Like when I've tried to present something or tell a story, and there isn't that reciprocal enthusiasm, how just all the air goes out of the room and I lose my sense, lose track of my my thread, and I can't really muster the energy, you know, to tell the story. It's like we need a storyteller needs an audience. It's essential. And the more enthusiastic the audience, the more alive the story becomes, I think. And it can be even a co-creative process.
Yeah, I think the co-creative process is really what is fun, that, you know, the experience of telling a story is not so much just that, oh, I tell kids something that is exciting to them, but I'm being fed by their excitement and the sense that something is happening that I don't know. I don't know how it turns out when I start it. It's kind of born in that co-creation, in that reaction. And so go ahead.
Oh, I'm just thinking, you mean you don't actually have the a sense, you're making it up as you go along sometimes? Is that what you're saying? When yeah. Okay.
I mean, sometimes I have an idea, but the beauty of it is really that it's making it up as I go along, because there is something about, and different kids or a kid a different day responds differently. Sometimes there's something about you say something and they respond, and so you reorient and you
Right.
go.
Yeah, and kids are so fluid with their imagination, and they don't treat it as something separate. It's just as real. I love that actually, that age. And I really find it sort of tragic when something happens. I think it's when they start school where their ability to flow with the imaginative world kind of dissipates, and it loses its magic qualities. And like they have imaginary friends, and they are very real. And then, yeah, sadly, we seem to lose it, although not everybody, like you were talking about active imagination and Peter Levine's conversation with Einstein. And Jung has had that lifelong dialogue with his anima and with Philemon, his like this character he has long conversations with, and they don't treat those characters as if they're pure figments of their own imagination. They're more like something real on the other side that answers back and surprises you.
I mean, so that's something that I've always loved about the Calvin and Hobbes stories, the comic strip, is that, I mean, I remember still when I first discovered the strip, it was a long series in which Hobbes was a full tiger. It's only at some point later that I saw him as a stuffed animal. And the story just does not work if you only think of Hobbes as a figment of Calvin's imagination, because so many things happen in which he's a real character. And so it's kind of a, it's in a place that's both outside of reality and you know it, but at the same time, it feels very real.
Yeah. I was just we're thinking about I used to sing Puff the Magic Dragon to Grace when she was a little kid, and how the storyline of the song, goes that Puff becomes like he just all the life goes out of him as soon as the boy loses his imaginative play, becomes like something that's relegated to the detritus of childhood, and it's like the dragon was animated by the imagination and then doesn't exist after a certain stage. I find it so tragic. I know it's not a tragic song, but to me
No, but
it
that it's
is.
really, I had actually forgotten that part when you mentioned it, but it's really, if you think of it, what happened to the Greek and Roman gods, that they existed as long as people believed in them, and then they become quaint things, that we have a hard time believing that people could actually feel awe of them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder, I mean, obviously I didn't live in those times, but I think my impression is just from reading the mythology and the literature is that they really it wasn't as if they thought that they were real flesh and blood people, but that they had a psychic reality that was very real and very much important to acknowledge and pay homage to, and that it would impact their lives, and that these gods had power, and it's almost like when she sort of take it and take that power away and just go, well, they're just like myth in a sense of not real, then there's just, again, I feel like there's a loss to that, because I think there is some truth to the reality of the imagination. I guess I, you know, just operate that way, and I feel like the world is so much more interesting and rich, viewing it that way.
So I like what you said. There's truth to the reality of the imagination, that sense of we use myth as the opposite of true. And there is such power in myth, and that's why I loved Yuval Harari, in Sapiens, talking about how much all of what we do is possible because we have that capacity to make up stories and to believe in them. And how much a lot of the things we think of as solid are actually myths. Not just that, say, religion or the things that we traditionally would put in that category, but something like a big business, General Motors, or money is essentially a myth. Without which we can't function.
That is, I've forgotten. I've read that book, and I'd forgotten about that essential piece of it. But it's true. You know, we just agree that this piece of paper is worth something, and or now it's like a digital, flash on our screen that's worth something. And if we didn't all agree, then it would be, the world would be entirely different. But it is imaginary.
It
In a
is imaginary,
way.
and it happens in connection. So that's how we come back to that sense of in the contact, in the connection, something is born. So that it's both imaginary and in connection.
Yeah, I think that's a key element. And I think about, I'm just thinking about active imagination, because that was kind of the idea that you sort of started with when you invited me to to have this conversation. And I have a practice of talking to them. Like, well, it's a Jungian idea, but and when you're trained as a Jungian, this is part of what we just do as a way to deepen our relationship with the dreaming world. And I think it also helps when you're exploring dreams with others as well. But my grandmother always shows up in these imaginal journeys, and it does feel like I'm really in relationship to her. And I mean, she died many, many years ago, but I do have a sense of her presence and her wisdom and her sense of humor. And these things come through that are not me. You know, they're really, it's not like I believe. Well, I actually don't know what I believe about how we converse with people who have passed away. I can't really say, because it's all a mystery to me. But it does feel like when I have these imaginal dialogues, there is a relationship, and there is a lot of give and take, and it's not me, and it's surprising what comes up from it, and in a really good way. And I think it's picking up on the thread of relationship. I think if we have a real relationship with our imagination, it relates back to us. It talks to us.
So you're as you're describing what happens in your dreams with your grandmother, you describe how there's a real relationship there. And at the same time, what you said is, I don't know what I believe. So that real relationship is independent of having a platform to justify the communication. It just is. There's something about that, and it doesn't have to be proven one way or another. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, the experience is its own, it's got its own value. And if I had to explain it, I don't know how I would, honestly. I don't think we, honestly, our sort of Western perspective, I don't think we have a complete picture of how the unseen world works. And I'm not saying that I know. I'm just saying I think there's more to it than meets the eye, or than that we allow to be sort of quote unquote reality. But I don't even, you're right, I don't even need to have a way to think about that, to have this active imaginal relationship. It just is. It just has a give and take quality that is really beautiful. It's a certain mindset, though. You know, it's like a daydream state, or it isn't kind of your everyday mind state that allows for it. It's like going back to that imaginal world of childhood, or of daydreaming, or a little bit of a, I wouldn't say a trance state. It's not like that, but I think you know the kind of state I'm talking about, where your mind is open and drifts, and things can come in that are not so pre-programmed or expected. There's a window we can open, and some people are really good at it. I'm okay at it. I think there's some people that are quite gifted at hearing those voices. You know, like Jung, for example, who obviously had a like long in-depth conversations with these other voices, and they were distinct from him.
And so that sense of the reality of it, my relationship to dreams is when I wake up, my recollection is that something happened that was real. And almost it's like it's in my mind as this happened, and it's only after time that it slowly filters to me to say, oh, this was a dream experience. But so in a way, it's just totally classified as it's an experience. And
Well, that is one of the incredible things about dreaming, is how, when we're in it, unless, you know, some people can become lucid and kind of aware of the dreaming process, which doesn't mean that it changes the reality of the dreaming, but they're actually aware when they're in it. But when we're not, it's even more interesting that our we have this ability to be immersed in an incredibly detailed, very real world that feels as authentic an experience as our waking experience. And it's only after we wake up that we go, oh, it was a dream and therefore not real. I don't know. I mean, I think it is its own version of reality. And you know, some really you know, like the some spiritual traditions will look at the, like the Tibetans have a dream yoga, and they don't necessarily see our waking life as the real life. They see maybe the dream life is actually more real life, and here we're kind of asleep, and they turn it around, and it's kind of fun, to a fun thought experiment. But I do think that it's incredible how we can have these worlds that are so real, down to the finest detail. And when you look around, it's not like my waking imagination has that capacity, you know, to create such an amazingly detailed experience. And so I always wonder about it. It's you know, I work with dreams, and I can see the benefit of spending time with what comes, but it feels like there's something beyond, oh, how can we use it, and you know, for our own psychological advancement. There's something else afoot as well beyond that.
To me, that's the beauty of it is, well, it's so amazing that in a way that something like this comes up. It's beautiful. Not necessarily the dream itself is beautiful in a conventional way, but it's just an amazing experience to have. It's so nice. It's so it's a built-in creative movie or whatever. Just and so when you're talking about lucid dream, my sense of what happens in therapy, not all the time, but sometimes, is it's kind of lucid dream in the sense that there is a universe in the session, which is like a dream because in some way, something is created that is not ordinary reality. And so, in some way or another, That it to me it has a quality, not all the time, but at good moments, something that's very similar to that telling a story where the story emerges. And so that sense of that it's not even any special technique, but the simple fact of listening to somebody in that mode, kind of creates, turns a session into a dreamlike co-created story. And so it's like a dream because it's not the real world, but at the same time, it has connections to it.
Yeah, I like that. I haven't really ever considered. I mean, sometimes I'll do sessions that are truly re-experiencing a dream, and so by definition, they become very dreamlike. But even you're talking about more the kind of give and take where there's a recollection or something comes up in relation to what's coming up for the person that you're sitting with, and that story takes a shape based on you as the listener and what's emerging between you and how memory operates too. I think memory's a tricky thing, and it's not precise either. It gets changed as we re-experience things, and I think that's partly what makes the therapy effective or helpful, is that we can tell a story in the presence of somebody who really cares and who's really listening in a certain way for those moments of where there's, I don't know, something emerging, some different way of being with it. And then the story changes, and or the person changes how they are with it. And so yeah, it is dreamlike in its ability to be fluid and affected by, I think dreams are like this too. They're affected by the feeling you bring to it, the lens that, the angle that you look at them at, how you tell it. And I do think some of the best therapy sessions are, someone starting with a story that might be a well-known, familiar story in the usual kind of grooves, and that it, the act of remembering it changes it to something else that's more current or more in keeping with how the person is now, or maybe they're bringing out their best version of themselves because of the way you listen. I'm just thinking out loud. It's just, I like this idea. I really do.
The when you were talking, you used the word fluid, and the word fluid feels really so right about it, because there's that sense of fluidity, just like in a dream. There's not, like, the logic is not the logic of ordinary reality, but it's a logic of something that changes moment by moment, and the settings can change. And so the fluidity feels very right there. And something you were saying toward the end, you said just retelling the story, or something like that. And I would go, it's not just in a way for me, just a retelling of the story as if the person is alone, but that telling in connection, where there is something in the listening that makes the story fluid. So that basically the experience of being in that kind of connection is what gives fluidity. And then brings into the dream world.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to say. Just maybe didn't quite express it. It's that the listener, then the presence of someone, especially someone who's really listening, holding the story in a loving way, in a open-minded way, that it allows the story to. It might have been that they started off saying, "Here, I'm going to tell you this story, and it's a familiar one," and then as I'm being really listened to, there's a way it changes on fly. It becomes something different, and it's held differently in the body. It becomes an updated version of what was. And I think of dreams this way too. This is a sort of what's emerging from all the years of dream work I've been doing, because I ask people to re-experience their dreaming. And I don't think it's that different from asking people to re-experience, say they're working through a memory from childhood that's really, it's going to be imperfectly remembered anyway, but then in retelling it with just an invitation to be with it right now, here and now. And in here and now, also, there's this listener that's with you, which is different already. And telling it, then it becomes updated. It's as though that was the version of events that got sort of reified, but it's not really how it is anymore. It's like the, I think we keep dreaming, our memories keep shifting and updating, and I think this just happens. It's how we're designed, but we don't know that until we actually tell it while we're feeling it, not just telling it from our mind of this is how I think it was, but more this is how it is. And because you're listening to me and you're with me, I am held in a way that I can really be telling it like it really is right now, and it's almost always better than we remember, or because we're just more capable as time goes on, and more have more capacity, more
And so
maturity.
you're talking about retelling the dream. And so how in retelling it, in the connection, in the held experience, then the dream has a fluidity so that it can reshape. And I think it also applies to a therapy without necessarily referring to a dream, or actually my sense of it is right, we're right in the middle of it. So we're in a conversation where there is that quality of fluidity because there's an intention at the beginning to talk about, broadly speaking, about active imagination, but not knowing exactly where it will go. And there is a quality of it evolving as it goes. And so my sense of it as we're proceeding is like we're riding that process that is evolving almost independently of what we're doing or in parallel to it.
Yes, this is an example of what we're speaking about
Yes.
exactly. Yeah, it is. It's a good one, because I think part of it is both of us have a willingness to just see where it goes. Neither of us have a particular agenda. I think it has to for the fluidity and the co-creativity, if you want, that requires that we don't have an endpoint already fixed. Which we didn't,
Which
and
we didn't. And what's interesting is as we're talking, now the image I have is the image of the worm in Dune. I don't know if you saw the movie Dune 1 or Dune 2. So
I saw
they
the first one, yeah.
so what they do is they harness, literally harness the worm and ride it. And so right now I have this image of, you know, in a way the humans who are relatively small compared to the worm, but they're carried by it, and at the same time, you know, they're harnessing it like you would a horse, but it's even less tame than a horse, so you can't just totally guide it. So the sense of something so powerful that you're carried by while riding it.
Oh, yeah, it's a fantastic analogy, and I think the scale is appropriate. The world of image and what Jung would call the unconscious, although I don't love the word unconscious, but that whole realm of imagination is so much bigger than we are, and yeah, it is, I think, good to have that humility in the face of it, to say that these ideas, this invitation to imagination and to allowing, I don't have best words for it, but we'll call it the big sandworm, that power, letting that infiltrate the conversation it is such it has such immense power to take us in to unexpected places. Like it's not a it's just I think of it as that power they're harnessing in Dune is dangerous. It's not just oh it's like a nice pony. You're right. It's like this is big. But if you have some skill, some courage, some willingness to just you have to be willing to go where it takes you because you're not going to be able to direct it too much, but you can go for a ride. Yes.
So I'm taking a moment just to see, in a way, like surprises, learnings, things of what emerged.
Well, for me, the most interesting piece of this is the idea that a therapeutic conversation and the way it can move and invite the unknown is like working with Dream, that they're similar in their ability to use imagination and the kindling that comes from the relationship. And it's not, it's now that you say it and we've sort of talked about it, it's not even new, a new idea. I think I operate that way, but I hadn't really thought about it. So I appreciate seeing it that way. It really is, yeah, it really makes, and not just the therapy conversation, but honestly, any conversation, this conversation, you know, it's like opening up when you're with somebody, when you have connection and an openness to see where it goes, you're actually opening the door to some powerful, magical things that could come in. And so that's exciting to me, this idea.
So I like when you describe it this way. It helps me articulate something that I was kind of sensing without having words for it. And so the sense that in some way, when we talk about listening, there is a sense of the listening being very much connected to what the other person says. So it would almost seem to be removing the notion of imagination because it's really trying to not project too much stuff into there. But what you're describing is the sense, you know, something very similar to the sense I have that there is actually some magic that's happening, and that's not about the literalness of repeating, but something where, in the process of trying to understand what you're saying and where you're coming from, and you trying to understand what I'm coming, where I'm coming from, there is actually something about connecting to a no man's land, some kind of field, which is the field where imagination lives, and there is that fluidity.
Absolutely. There's the fluidity and there's a more. There's something that gets added by the by virtue of the overlap of our attempts to communicate. It there's something else that comes in that's bigger than me or you separately.
So we're in the presence of the more, and we're playing with it and interacting with it and kind of bathing in it. And that's what creates that dreamlike type of storytelling, creativity.
Yeah, and also I think what when you're, you know, brainstorming with somebody, how much more likely it is that you're going to come up with something new and creative in this back and forth than if you are just in your own just in your own sphere. I mean, you can, I suppose that, you know, in the act of imagination where you're bringing in an imaginal other, you're creating that dynamic with a dream figure or a imaginal figure, it's probably not that different, but there it's that extra layer, the relationship of being open to what the other brings and their understanding of it is always going to add something else.
Right.
It's like
So
just,
what you're saying here is, okay, so it's creating a virtual relationship because in a way this stuff happens in relationship. So that virtual relationship of the imaginary other is kind of bringing it from isolation to relationship.
yeah, that might be why to circle back around, that might be why it is that, some very creative people, they will use this method of just not just these are my ideas I'm putting down and I'm taking ownership of them as if I've created them, but I've actually been in dialogue with something other than myself. Living imaginary Einstein or Jung's filament or something where there's really another, and it's not just I'm putting words in their mouth. I'm actually not. I'm invoking something larger than myself, something else, someone else. And in that back and forth in the in between, that's where the creative spark emerges. Something beyond what we know
So as
individually.
I'm listening to you there, it feels like a very nice way to sum up to me that feels like a good resting place. And I want to just check if there is something more that wants to come out from either you or me.
I feel complete. I feel like this was an amazing and fun conversation to have.
This is part of the Active Pause podcast. To see more and subscribe to the newsletter, go to activepause.com.